Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Housing Crisis and Displacement in London. And we are delighted to be joined today by Paul Watt, who is visiting professor in the Department of Sociology here at the London School of Economics. He has published widely on social housing, urban regeneration, displacement, homelessness, housing activism, gentrification, and the 2012 London Olympic Games. He is the co-editor with Pierre Smets of Social Housing and Urban Renewal, a cross-national perspective published by Emerald in 2017, and co-editor with Phil Cohen of London 2012 and the Post-Olympic City, a Hollow Legacy, also published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. His most recent book is Estate Regeneration and Its Discontents, Public Housing, Place and Inequality in London, published by Policy Press in 2021. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thanks very much, Romola. Glad to be here.
We're really glad that you could join us on this podcast. You know, I mean, you've done so much work on London and you've written about it for so long and your research has been so incredibly rich and so inspiring to so many of us. And I wanted to sort of have a conversation around a lot of the stuff that you've worked on for all these years and kind of start by talking about the housing crisis in London. Okay. Talk to us about why you think this has come about and what you think the long-term causes of that have been.
Okay, about 2014, I started getting phone calls from newspaper journalists saying, could you tell us about the housing crisis and when did it start? And most of them seemed to assume that it had begun, I don't know, 2010 or something with austerity. My response was that the London housing crisis and the national housing crisis has been really decades in the making. So it's basically a long-running train crash. And I should just say that there is a national housing crisis, but very much the epicentre, the spatial epicentre of the housing crisis is London for all kinds of reasons. And the housing crisis really dates back to the 1980s. You have then the introduction of neoliberal housing policies, particularly the right to buy, introduced by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980 Housing Act. You also had virtually, not a ceasing, but you had a real slowdown in the amount of council housing, public housing that was built in London and across the country generally. And basically then you've had a long-term shrinkage of the size of the social housing sector. And that's been really, that's one of the key factors in the contemporary housing crisis or housing emergency, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it. Various other things have come about. And one was that there was the 1988 Housing Act. And basically what that did was that deregulated private tenancies. So it meant then that it was much easier to evict tenants so through what's called no-fault evictions. Right. So most private tenants after 1988 were put on what were called assured short-haul tenancies. And these could then be 6 months or 12 months. And basically at the end of that, even if they pay the rent, perfect tenant, they could be evicted if the landlord then wanted to put the rent, basically. Mm-hmm. So you've had a deregulation of the private rental sector. You've had a shrinkage of the social housing sector, and those are national trends. But also, in particular, in relationship to London. London then is, you know, it's a global city, and it's been at the epicentre of global financial flows, particularly in relationship to property housing property investment. So you've had then the phenomenon of the super rich.
Yes.
So basically then that itself has been a piling into the central London housing market, but also increasingly the East London housing market from international property investors. That's contributed towards the increase in house prices. And also another factor is what's called the rise of buy-to-let mortgages. And these were introduced at the end of the 1990s. So what that's done is then it encouraged private landlordism. And then the spatial, again, very much the spatial epicentre of the buy-to-let market is London. So what you've got then is a sort of perfect storm of kind of like speculative property investment piling into the London housing market. House prices and private rents are going up. At the same time then that housing for need, social housing, traditional social housing, either in the form of council housing provided by local authorities or in the form of social housing provided by housing association, voluntary sector housing association. If you go back to 1981, at that point, just over a third of London households rented from social landlords. And now, the latest data, 2021, is that that's less than a quarter. So there's been an absolute and a relative contraction in the size of the social housing sector in London. Private rental sector has increased in size, now is bigger than the social rental sector. But the problem, of course, is that the private rental sector is very deregulated. So you've got all kinds of like pressures that have come about in London. You've got gentrification pressures. And then if an area is gentrifying, because it's very easy for landlords to evict people, they see rents going up in the area, and then basically then they will evict low-paying tenants and get in high-paying tenants. So all of these things have sort of come together to sort of create a perfect storm around housing in London.
You know, you laid out this very comprehensive discussion of the housing crisis. Could you tell us a little bit about how this then plays out into temporary housing as well?
Sure. So temporary accommodation is that's the housing then that if people apply to the council or the authority as homeless, they will typically be placed in temporary accommodation. Now, this has been, this has been going on for decades. But again, what we've seen is a sort of a, with the housing crisis, there's been a radical transformation in the conditions of temporary housing in London. So, and it, you can see that in several ways. So first is that there's been a huge expansion in the numbers of people in temporary accommodation in London. So if you go back then to 2010, there was about 50,000 households in temporary accommodation, London households in temporary accommodation. Last year, there were 123,000 households. So it's more than doubled. And unbelievably, there are 91,000 children currently living in temporary accommodation in London. So the scale of that is absolutely huge. So, you know, that's you're basically talking about, you know, a sizable town, really. Now, there are several factors that have gone along with this increase in temporary accommodation. One important factor is the way that people are spending much longer time periods in temporary accommodation. So if you go back to the period of the 1980s, people might be in temporary accommodation, say, 6 months or a year, and then eventually they would probably be rehoused in public housing. That doesn't happen anymore. What now happens is that people can spend years in temporary accommodation, so-called temporary accommodation. I actually interviewed somebody last year who lived in temporary accommodation for 19 years.
Oh my gosh.
So and people living in a temporary accommodation for 5 years, more than 5 years, up to 10 years, is no longer uncommon, basically. Now, what then happens in terms of, because temporary accommodation is inherently insecure, so what then happens is that people get evicted and moved on from their different forms of temporary accommodation. So you get this phenomenon of what I call recurrent displacement. So basically then people can have, you know, several different forms of temporary accommodation over a time period. Another thing that's happened is that increasingly people are being moved outside of their borough of origin.
Yes.
So now about nearly 45% of all London households are in temporary accommodation. They've actually been moved out of the borough of origin.
Mm.
There's also been an increase in the numbers of people who have moved out of the city altogether.
Yes.
So if you go back to 2012, something like 600 households, London households were moved outside of the city. Mm-hmm. By the time you get to about 10 years later, mm-hmm. you're talking about over 2,500 households.
Wow.
So there's a geographical widening mm-hmm. of the people being moved out.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of these kind of displacement factors then have intensified
mm-hmm.
and made it very, very difficult for people in temporary accommodation. Often the quality of accommodation is very poor.
Mm.
People talk about, you know, I've followed people out of the city to Welling Garden City, for example,
right.
to a hostel there. People were living in infested dwellings. It's high levels of overcrowding, really poor conditions. No play space for children. And, you know, I've constantly been shocked myself.
Mm-hmm.
People are often moved out to these places. They don't know anybody there. They've got no support networks, so they're left.
When you have, you are required to provide, especially, in relation to the rights of children and
yeah.
so forth, you are supposed to provide
yeah.
certain things to families and a certain amount of stability as well. I mean, it's not just families, but loads of others
yeah.
as well. As you were saying that the numbers are increasing.
Yeah.
And this is not just an expansion of numbers, but also the practices themselves are becoming more normalized.
Yeah, sure. And one of the aspects of this is the way that when people apply as homeless, typically what happens is this,
mm-hmm.
is that say, for example, they're going to be evicted by a private landlord. They contact the local authority. The local authority will say, okay, so on the day that you're being evicted, come down to the council building, come down to the harvest offices, and we'll assess your case, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've sat with people. So they can sit there from 9 to 5, 4 o'clock, they're called into the office,
mm-hmm.
and basically then the case is assessed, and then they said, okay, so we've got some temporary accommodation for you, but it's in Bournemouth. It's in Welling Garden City, it's across the other side of London. Now, at that point, if the person says, I don't want to go there, basically I don't know anybody there, I've got no support networks,
right.
my parents are here, got small children, kids are in school.
Mm-hmm.
If they say, I really, really don't think I can actually go to this place,
mm-hmm.
then there's something called intentional homelessness
yes.
kicks in. So basically then, it was a clause that was introduced in the 1977 Housing Act,
mm.
and it means then that if somebody then refuses an offer of accommodation, which could be, temporary accommodation, if they refuse this then, effectively, they have made themselves intentionally homeless.
Right.
And at that point, the council can say, we've made you an offer, you've refused this, we will then discharge our duty,
mm.
our housing duty towards you. So that's the it's what I call it's like a mafia offer.
Right.
It's an offer you
yeah.
can't refuse, basically.
Right.
Women, and particularly many of the people that I've interviewed have been female single parent families with
mm.
kids, and basically they say at that point they kind of break down in tears in the office. And they're kind of forced into this position that they have to then move to wherever they're told to.
Right.
And it's a really kind of, it's one of the kind of the underlying, violence.
Yes, exactly.
That underpins
yeah.
the austerity, the cuts, the neoliberalisation of housing that has gone on.
Yes.
So it is underpinned by violence. And women have told me that, that they've also been threatened that their kids will be taken off them. Because
oh, wow.
because they're not actually being, fit parents.
Yes, of course.
So that's the kind of sometimes it's an implicit threat. Sometimes people have told me it's an explicit threat.
Right.
So basically that's one of the... So it's like if you can't actually provide housing for your kids,
yeah.
we're going to take your kids off you, basically.
Right.
So the whole thing is really, really, fraught with, you know, all this, you know, this underpinning authoritarianism. Again, it's the way that neoliberalism, it's not simply about the state vacating the space. It's about the state changing its operation and operating in a particular punitive manner towards the homeless.
Yeah, the word coercion was coming to mind as you were saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a coercive process. Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, I was thinking as you were saying that, it's because you mentioned that it was also the day that they were getting evicted, which means that you are put in a desperate situation because you will, in effect, be homeless within a few hours. So I'm assuming that whatever accommodation they're being given, they're being expected to move into it
pretty soon.
Very soon.
Yeah. So it might be, you know, some cases it's like there and then, in some cases it might be the next day. But, you know, I interviewed a woman who was from Newham about 10 years ago now, and she had three young kids, marriage had broken down. Yeah, and basically then she had, you know, 24 hours to up all of the life in East London and move out to Welwyn Garden City, which is a town about 25 miles north of London.
And enroll her children into a new school.
Well, that's
there.
It. You see what? Yeah, it's kind of like there's all of that because there's people are given. There's no kind of like support put in place for when people have moved out to these places. They're just literally kind of dumped, basically.
Right.
So you know they often you know they struggle to get the electricity turned on, all kinds of things that they're facing. Yeah, and so what some people do is they kind of do these. This Herculean endeavours. They keep their kids in school in London. So they basically then, they kind of like then go back, they're ferrying their kids back to London because they're bothered about disrupting their kids' education, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, the whole thing, you know, again, as I said, some of the accommodations, really, really, it's tiny. I interviewed one family from, I think they were from Tower Hamlets, as a Bangladeshi family, two kids, a parent, mum and a dad. It was just basically a studio flat. There's no separate bedroom. There's just a kitchen, the bedroom, the living room was all together.
Wow.
And this was originally nurses' accommodation. It was nursing accommodation for single nurses. Then you got there's a family of four. So basically what you had was this position whereby the mum and the two kids slept on the beds. And then the father, he slept on the floor in between the TV and the sofa, basically. And, you know, this is temporary accommodation. Now, you might say, temporary. So, you know, a few weeks, you might be able to, you know, live with that. They'd been there for 2.5 years.
Oh, my goodness.
2.5 years. Young kids, there's no play space for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the, you know, it really is, and the basically the father, he did go back into London to work, and I think he worked in the restaurant business, and but eventually had to pack it in because he just simply couldn't afford it, basically. So there are often negative employment impacts on this. So it's not simply that people in, you know, low pay that causes displacement and homelessness. It's that the homelessness itself can actually lead to people then losing their jobs. And a really kind of terrible set of circumstances.
I mean, I think the word punitive here is very appropriate. I think that's the right word to use over here, that in effect what you are doing is punishing the poor.
Yeah. It's really interesting that because that's the way that they often, many of the people that I've interviewed and they've said it's like we've done something wrong.
Yeah.
It's like we've committed some sort of crime.
Right.
And the local authority is punishing us. Mm-hmm. They've moved us out to this place and we're basically stuck here.
I wanted to ask you also about this kind of question of regeneration and social housing, and also talk about how that's led to displacement of people.
Yeah. Okay, so what's happened is over the last, since the 80s, 90s, is that some social housing estates, so these are typically estates that have been built by the local authority, by the council, so public housing, some of the estates have been underinvested in for many years. So basically then various regeneration schemes are put in place. some of those regeneration schemes can have a sort of a social component. So, for example, you might have improved education facilities or health facilities or employment training facilities. But some of the regeneration schemes also can also involve a physical dimension. So in other words, then there's some sort of change in the actual, the built environment. And that can take different forms. It could be refurbishments. It could be the infilling of estates with more homes. But it could also involve demolition. Demolition and rebuilding. And that's primarily the kind of regeneration that I've looked at. So whereby an existing social housing estate is demolished and it's then rebuilt. But when it's rebuilt, it's not rebuilt as a social housing estate. It's rebuilt as what's called a mixed tenure community. So you will often have then large numbers of private housing, market housing for sale or rent. And the point is that this is what's called a cross-subsidy model of regeneration, in which then the provision of the new private market housing, it helps to fund any replacement of the social housing. So it's a radical transformation that occurs in relationship to the demographics of estates. So before, putting it simply, estates are primarily multi-ethnic working class spaces in London. Afterwards is that they, you know, essentially it's a process of, putting it crudely, state-led gentrification. So as then you get, and often many of the new homes, the new market homes, they're often extremely expensive, even by the standards of London. So, for example, if you take one of the most famous examples of the Haygate Estate, which has now been demolished, which is an estate in the Elephant and Castle area of the Borough of Southwark, that was then demolished and it's now been rebuilt and rebranded as what's called Elephant Park. there was a 90% loss of social housing and something like only 100 social rental homes were provided. The previous estate had got about 1,000 council homes.
Oh my gosh.
So this is the most, you know, it's the most egregious example of estate regeneration as state-led gentrification in London. Worst case example in many ways. But also the properties that are the private market properties for sale in the Elephant Park, the average price for a 2-bed flat is getting on for over £1 million. That's about that's over double the average prices for flats in the Borough of Southwark. So it's not simply that these that you're getting market homes. It's just that many of the market homes, they're kind of like quite expensive, very expensive luxury market homes, basically. So what happens in terms of, so the demolition process, the regeneration process, it involves a kind of like a multi-layered process of displacement. And there's, in effect, there's a hierarchy in relationship to people, the original residents' rehousing rights. So if you take then the original social housing tenants, typically the council housing tenants, they're probably at the top of the hierarchy because essentially they have the best rehousing rights. The deal is usually that they can get a right to return if there are enough social housing homes reprovided on the estate. If they don't, for whatever reason, there aren't enough homes reprovided, or if it's the case that they don't want to come back to these new social rental homes for whatever reason, they then have got the right to be accommodated in another council property elsewhere in the borough. However, whether they come back to the estate, the rebuilt estate or not, is dependent on a whole variety of factors. First is how much social housing is reprovided. So, as I said, in the case of the Haygate Estate and Elephant Park, there was a 90% loss of social housing. And the it's only thought that less than 50 of the original Haygate residents moved back. Some estates are better. So, for example, I've done a lot of work on Woodbury Down, which is in the London Borough of Hackney. There was only a 15% loss of social housing. Still a social loss of housing, which is bad, given London's housing crisis.
Of course.
But nevertheless, not as radical as the shift that you got at the Haygate and Elephant Park. But it also depends whether social tenants want to come back. Also depends on a bunch of factors. One is about the affordability, because often is that the rents and the service charges go up at the new estate. So in some cases, they might not want to go back. There's also often a shift in landlords, so they often transfer from a council landlord to a housing association landlord. Mm. Again, some social tenants don't particularly want to do that. And last is, it also depends on the length of time. Because one of the things that really kind of, it took a while for me myself to kind of realise when I was doing the research, one of the key aspects about estate regeneration, particularly under the cross-subsidy model, is the sheer length of time that this takes.
Mm.
They're nominally, these estate regeneration schemes, they're normally supposed to take 10 years, right. 15 years. They can take 20, 25, 30, 35 years.
Oh, wow.
The case at the Aylesbury is a good example. The regeneration there began under the in 1998. It was subject to a new Dulf Communities programme under New Labour. The Aylesbury regeneration scheme, that's not going to complete until 2035.
Oh my gosh.
Woodbury Downs, another example in Hackney, as I've mentioned. Again, that they were talking about that back in the late 1990s. The council put in plans in the early 2000s. It's an eight-phase scheme. They're in the middle of phase four. It's, again, this isn't going to complete until 2035. So one of the kind of like the awful ironies of this process is that when residents have said, look, you know, we're going to come in, the council will say, we're going to demolish your old homes, we're going to give you better homes, we're going to improve the neighbourhood, better facilities. But of course, given the demographics of council housing populations, mm-hmm. many of whom are elderly, they pass away well before the promised land of the regeneration actually arrived. Estates are also kind of, they're multi-tenure. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks of them as mono-tenure, but they're not anymore, partly because of the right to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So what you now have as an estate is, you know, somewhere between 20 and 50% of the people living on estate, council mm-hmm. estates, social housing estates, can actually be homeowners. These mm-hmm. are then people who either bought under the right to buy or people who then have bought off the original right to buy owners, yeah. market owners. Now, their position is very different because they don't have any guaranteed right to return. What they get is financial compensation for existing property. So typically, if they're owner-occupiers, they're living in the property, they will get the market rate for the flat or the house plus 10%.
Okay.
But the whole point about estate regeneration is that it unlocks the land values, the latent land values.
Yeah.
So what happens then is that the new properties that are rebuilt on the estates, you're talking about double, mm-hmm. typically double, maybe even three times the cost. So they're given, so for example, I did some work at an estate up in North London, and the original offers that the tenants got there, the original leaseholders got there, £90,000 for one bed, £130,000 for a two-bed. And the new homes on the estates, we're talking about £300,000-£400,000.
Of course, yeah.
So it's simply not enough for them to be able to buy a new home on the estate. There can be what's called shared ownership offers, whereby you can get into a part ownership, part buy, part rent mm-hmm. situation. But many leaseholders, they're not very keen on that because they say, well, I own all of my property now.
Yeah.
Why would I just get into a position of owning just half of it or whatever? Also, again, given the sort of the demographics of people on estates, again, many of the leaseholders, they tend to be elderly.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get a mortgage. So the leaseholders, they're as a group, they're much, much less likely to return to any new built properties on the estate compared to the original council tenants, basically. So many of those are displaced away. So there are if you look at there's famous maps have been done by the 35% campaign in Southwark about the Haygate displacement, and you can see that the council tenants were more likely to stay in the borough of Southwark, but the leaseholders were much more geographically scattered, more likely to move not only outside Southwark, but also outside London altogether, displacement outside. You also have again, because of the right to buy, so you have private landlords on estates who then are renting out to private tenants. Private tenants have got no rehousing rights whatsoever, unless they're on the homelessness register. So they will all be displaced away. And also then you have temporary non-secure tenants. Because what happens is that, again, this process, it unfolds over years and years and years. So the councils will then decant some of their original council tenants. They will buy out some of the leaseholders. But they're then faced with the prospect of having empty properties. At the same time, they've got rising numbers of people on their homelessness. They haven't got anywhere to put them.
Right.
It's expensive to lease private homes in the market. So what they will then do is they will use their empty properties on estates to put their homeless households in. But again, but because of the fact that they have no social housing for these, or there's very little social housing for those people to go to, and as I said before, people in temporary accommodation could be living on these estates for years and years. So again, many of the people that I've interviewed who were temporary non-secure tenants who have been put on estates, they might have been living on these estates for 5 years, 10 years, their kids are going to the local schools, but because they were not the original social housing tenants, typically they have no rehousing rights. So they then are very likely to be cleared off altogether. And typically then they'll go to another temporary accommodation site, either in the borough or out of the borough. So it's a very, very kind of like layered, complex process of displacement and rehousing. Yes. Who gets rehoused and who doesn't get rehoused. There are kind of interesting ethnic issues around this as well.
Yeah.
Because the demographics of many of the people in temporary accommodation, they often tend to be black minority ethnic populations. So again, there's kind of like an ethnic, an ethnic dimension, racialized dimension to the way that all of these kind of like complex displacement processes play out. The other factor, as I said, is that what tends to happen is that because the private market properties on the estates, on the rebuilt estates, they tend to be at higher values.
Yeah.
So it means then that people living in local surrounding private renting, they also are much more likely to get displaced because they can't afford the new rent space.
Of course, yeah.
So the whole thing is like creating this kind of displacement juggernaut, if you like.
Yes, exactly.
But it plays out with different effects depending on the housing tenure categories that people are in.
Is the state even aware that they're creating all of these different and interrelated processes? Do they even care?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, again, I think that when I've interviewed local politicians about this, I think that they are aware of what's going on.
Right.
And it depends which side of the fence that you know, it's like if they're doing the process, they tend to think, well, it's kind of like acceptable collateral damage, basically.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's kind of like, well, you know, okay, but the greater good, we're going to kind of like, you know, because the argument is that the original social tenants will get better homes. That's the argument.
My mind is blown with what you've talked about. I can't believe that all these different and complex and overlapping processes have been taking place and, you know, creating these different forms of displacement. And we obviously see the spatial effects of that everywhere in London. The city has changed so drastically. Yeah. But surely there's pushback on this. And I was wondering, again, because you've done work on this for so long, you know, if you want to tell us in closing, maybe on a hopeful note,
that there's
something happening against some of these quite punitive policies.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been involved in housing campaigns myself now, going back to the 90s. And one of the things that, when I was sitting in meetings in the 1990s, and people used to complain then, and they used to say, where are the young people? Where are the young people? We need more young people involved in these housing campaigns. Well, two things have happened over the last 10, 15 years. One is that there's been an explosion of housing campaigns in London who have been challenging all different aspects of the housing crisis. So you have groups then like the London Renters Union, who, you know, in some cases are directly challenging evictions. You have campaigns like 35% and Just Space, which operate on a planning dimension, basically. And you have campaigns like Defend Council Housing, which have been championing council housing. And there are a whole load of campaigns which have been based around particular estates, which have been challenging the demolition of the estates. So, for example, in Barnet, there was a campaign, I looked at West Hendon Estate, there's a campaign there called Our West Hendon. There is six estates in Lambeth are under threat of demolition. So you have Save Central Hill Estate, you have Save Cressingham Gardens Estate. So there's been a whole sort of, plethora of these campaigns. And what's been really, really important and encouraging is the way that many of these campaigns have been driven by young people. And again, one campaign that I've spent a lot of time on is Focus E15 in London. And this was then a campaign which emerged out of the housing struggles of a group of young mums in Newham who were facing the threat of eviction. And basically then when they went to the council said to them, well, we can help you to get new property, but it's going to be outside of the city, basically. Mm. So Focus E15, the campaign was formed then, partly, out of then, challenging the eviction then of these young mums. And that's been going now, I should just say, from since 2013.
Yes.
So there's been a whole range of these different campaigns and they have had various kind of successes. So, for example, in the case of Focus E15, they occupied one half-empty council estate, which was supposedly regenerating. And they got to the, they occupied it, and then eventually the council then did put, rehouse some people onto the estate. So some campaigns have actually, they've either stopped demolition altogether, or they've been successful in scaling it back, basically. Mm. So there have been a whole range of different campaigns, and so some of them had, they've got all kinds of successes. And I think one of the important factors, which is not talked about enough, really, probably within the academic literature as well, is I think that, because housing's very personal, because it's sort of people's domestic space, people often take it very personally. And they feel quite isolated, that they as being punished in some kind of way. And one of the important benefits of these campaigns is that it brings people together, it lets people see that they're not alone, and it has really important therapeutic benefits. Many people have said this to me, is that they really felt isolated until they realised that there was a bigger campaign which was actually trying to take on the housing concerns that they had. So I think that's been a really, really important part. And certainly in terms of, again, the Focus E15, they occupied the Carpenter's Estate back in 2014. And that was a really pivotal moment in many ways, because what it did, because they got massive media publicity from that, and it really pushed the housing crisis up the media agenda, but also up the political agenda. And I think that's what one of the effects of the housing campaigns is, that they really have been able to, highlight and push it up the agenda.
Wow. Well, let's hope that there'll be more of that, and, fingers crossed, because the picture that you painted is very grim and disturbing. And it's very troubling to see the ways in which so many different people are being displaced out of the city in so many different ways, and, the kind of punitive measures that the state takes with people who are so vulnerable and so precariously housed. And I do, again, I do find it really surprising that there isn't more discussion around some of these in the media and elsewhere, and how some of this stuff is also legal. I find that really extraordinary. I mean, I feel like I could talk to you about this for hours and days, but I feel like we should bring this to a close. But thank you so much for being on the podcast today and talking to us about such an interesting and complex discussion and being able to really make it so accessible. That's, I mean, I really appreciate that because, you know, all these kinds of discussions are so, as you pointed out, that they're so interlinked and, you know, there's so many different layers to them, and being able to distill them down into a conversation that is really accessible is really fantastic. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Marilla, for having me. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope that your listeners get something out of this.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks very much.